1856, the man considered to be Canada's colonial poet laureate wrote a poem about a war that happened 40 years prior, one that happened before he was born. But the passion and admiration he feels for the people who fought in it is undeniable. Listen to this. Here is the monument, Immortal Brock, whose ashes lie beneath it. Not more still than is the plain today. What have we gained but a mere breath of fame for all the blood that flowed profusely on this stirring field? 'Tis true, a victory through which we still fling forth the meteor banner to the breeze, and have a blood-sealed claim upon the soil. 'Twere better than defeat 1,000 times, and we have rightly learned to bless the name of the old land, whose courage won the day. We, the descendants of the victor sires. Why would this poet write such praise for a war he never knew? What value did that conflict have on his life, if any? And most importantly, what impact did it have on the life of Canada? Find out today and more on Historia Canadiana. Hello and welcome to Historia Canadiana. My name is Patrick, and this is a podcast about Canadian culture, usually literature, and the way it interprets and informs this nation's history. Before I forget, I want to tell you guys that there have been some additions and changes to the show, some stuff that I'm really excited about. So stick around at the end if you want to hear more. Today, we're going to talk about war. Specifically, we're jumping to the start of the 19th century, to a two-year-long war. One that is pretty well known in Canada, especially since the 200-year anniversary passed not too long ago, so that moment would still be fresh in people's minds through the events surrounding its remembrance. But, as we'll see, this war that pitted the United States against Britain through Canada, despite being less grandiose than other wars that took place on Canadian soil prior to it, seems to have had more of an impact on the imagination of Canadians who lived through it at the time, through the likes of poets like John Richardson, as well as our first returning writer to this show. Let's look at military poems and writings that begin to take more of a look at Canada as a thing worthy of admiration in its own right, rather than as a shadow of its British colonial master. Let's look at the War of 1812. To fully understand, we must first dial back the clock a little bit and cross an ocean to Europe, because this war, like any historical event, did not happen in a vacuum. It is essentially one part of a war that involved France, America, and Canada, with Great Britain at the center connecting all three of them. If you want to be really precise about this, this is a war that centers around Britain and its ability to screw over a massive chunk of the world with a few boats. I'm oversimplifying for the sake of comedy, but you'll see what I mean soon. Let's first go back to 1806, when Napoleon Bonaparte was making some serious waves in Europe as he was setting out to build his own empire. That's right, folks, this story about Canada starts with everyone's favorite diminutive tyrant. Alright, the diminutive part is a myth that was started by British propagandists, but you get the gist. Napoleon wanted to really stick it to the British in 1806. And he did so by closing off Western Europe to all British goods. The thing is, the British had the means to strike back, really hard. In 1807, their government dispatched some of its navy, which was already well on its way to becoming the most powerful in history by that point, and installed a naval blockade on France that stopped ships from trading with the heart of Napoleon's empire. This included American ships, who were not officially a part of the conflict, but that were boarded and seized upon anyway. This, my friends, is what I call a massive kick in the Western world's balls. But really, if it had ended there, the whole thing might have gone over with a slight fuss, but certainly not a full-blown war. But of course, it didn't, did it? Let's turn to North America and see what was brewing over there. This has been touched on briefly in the past, but in the aftermath of the American Revolution, the relations between the British and their former colony did not completely sever from one day to the next. For example, The British still held some forts to the south of the St. Lawrence in the US. These areas became quite useful when it became increasingly difficult for the British government in Canada to settle the influx of loyalists coming in from the States. This all inevitably caused some tensions. Although the British never seemed to intend to attempt a reconquest of America from those few forts, it was the principle and the image that it gave off to the Americans that the British were still present on their territory in some form or another. In 1794, these forts were ceded once and for all to the Americans, although Canadians continued to trade in the area. I mean, border security was really not all that impressive at the time. Canadians and British people continued to do commerce south of Upper Canada with the native populations that lived there. These people preferred to interact with British rather than the Americans, actually, as they saw the former as the lesser of two evils. The British were seen as more assimilationist, yes, but ultimately better than the violent Americans who just wanted to actively eliminate the natives from the land. The British also had plans to set up a Native American territory around these Great Lakes, just northwest of the Ohio River, which helped their case in dealing with the natives. There are inevitably problems that occurred with Canadian and British people with the natives, but that was at least the reasoning and perception of the time for the indigenous population to trade with them. Anyway, the point is that the Native Americans tended to side with the British and resisted American settlement into the land set aside for them. In 1811, things would actually turn violent in what is known as the Battle of Tippecanoe, pitting the Americans, who wanted to expand west, against a group of natives led by Tecumseh and his brother. Hold on to the name Tecumseh. He'll become important later. This battle was significant because it kind of gave an opening to American expansionists seeking a campaign into Canada, one that would hopefully solve the issues that had been brewing and give the Americans a more solid basis on which to deal with Great Britain. Furthermore, around this time in the American South, westward expansion was heading into Spanish territory. The Spanish were allies of, well, you guessed it, the British. So let's recap, shall we? Because that was a lot of context. The British and the French are fighting. The British stop boats and trade from getting into France with their own navy. This affects the Americans, who are already having problems with the British near their own borders with Canada. The Americans see an opportunity to go to war with the British, who they see as still being too present on their land, and take it. We have now reached 1812. The Americans are ready, in their own minds, to re-establish their independence, and do so by invading Canada. There's just one problem. The British kind of like having Canada around. Historian Barry M. Gow sums up the American mentality going into this battle very succinctly. Quote, "Hopes by American war hawks of quickly taking Canada proved optimistic. The U.S. Congress underestimated British power in North America and the determination of the imperial power to retain its colonies. Congress believed that American troops would be welcomed as liberators in Upper Canada, where many former Americans resided. Thomas Jefferson opined that it would be a mere matter of marching. Such thinking resulted in strategic errors. American forces chose to attack east of the Detroit River first, rather than several lines of communications between Montreal and Kingston, which would have rendered Upper Canada helpless." End quote. The British and Canadian troops started off with quite the advantage in a series of successes from 1812 to 1813, with notable involvement from General Isaac Brock and the aforementioned Tecumseh. I'll cover the start of the war by looking at both individually, but there is inevitably some overlap to be expected. Let's begin with General Brock, a man who, upon arriving in Canada in 1803, had immediately set out to strengthen its fortifications and improve its militia, which was mostly composed of Canadians in the lower ranks and British personnel as officers. As he noted himself, he was a bit peeved at being stationed in, quote, "this remote corner of the empire," end quote, and sought to prove himself in every way possible to his superiors. As such, when the conflict between the British and Americans broke out in 1812, he immediately went on the offense, meeting with the enemy that was trying to cross into Canada around Detroit, immediately after the British, under a different commander, had already captured Fort Michilimackinac. This is where Tecumseh comes into play. As a Shawnee leader who would muster up hundreds of his warriors to aid the British in these first battles, natives, as well as British and Canadian soldiers, fought alongside each other to take that American fort, and would continue to do so as a battle was fought over Detroit, and would keep their association going for quite some time. In August of 1812, General Brock, with his army and the help of Tecumseh and 600 of his men, took Detroit from General William Hull. An anecdote that is often tossed around when referring to the battle is that Brock and Tecumseh won not only due to their superior strategy, but because they intimidated Hull by making him think that they had 5,000 natives on the British side. The numbers vary slightly, but the point remains. A mix of military proactiveness, strategy, and intimidation secured significant early fights for the British and convinced the native people of Upper Canada that this war might actually go quite well and quickly. It also gave the confidence boost to Brock and the British, who would move on to Queenston Heights with quite a bit of gusto. And it is with this that we will finally get to our first literary pit stop. We're returning to the works of Jonathan Odell, who we covered in the Loyalists episode as a Tory satirist. He will kick us off here with a poem entitled The Battle of Queenstown, Upper Canada, which was written not long after the outcome of the battle was secured in 1812. Odell would have written this from New Brunswick, where he lived until his death, but this goes to show how big a wave this war was already making and how seriously people took it as the news traveled fast from Upper Canada to New Brunswick and was deemed important enough to write about. It's very short, so here it is in full. Again with confidence elate, the invading foe was found, a captive's unexpected fate on our Canadian ground. Triumphant as before, though still outnumbered by the foe, our chiefs again have shown how skill can deal the unerring blow. Again we boast, but with a sigh, a brilliant day's career, for Brock demands from every eye the tribute of a tear. Devoted to this country's cause, the soldier's debt he paid. From age to age, with just applause, his name shall be conveyed. The Battle of Queenston Heights was, as is implied by the poem, General Brock's last stand. But before dying of the wounds he was inflicted of on the battlefield, he managed to lead his troops, which were again composed of a mix of British, Canadian, and natives, this time the Iroquois, to a point where they were able to encircle and force the Americans to surrender. The invaders had attempted to cross into Canada through Niagara River, but were once again stopped before they got too far, leading to about 900 American prisoners being taken. This fight would provide a different kind of reaction from the Canadian population than the one at Fort Michilimackinac. Contrary to the previous battle that Brock had led his forces in, this one had a different weight to it. York, which was the name given to Toronto at the time, was not very far, and while it was most certainly not even close to being the contemporary Toronto, it would still have been quite the victory and strategic gain for the Americans. This battle proved that Canadians could hold their ground on their territory and convinced many more that this was a land worth defending. This is particularly clear in the Jonathan Odell poem. He references in the first stanza that Canada is our Canadian ground. There is a sentiment, one that existed prior to this point, but that has an increasing ability to be voiced now, that Canada is a land that goes beyond the British grasp. It showed itself to be not only able, but willing to defend itself, effectively creating a distinction between wanting to be Canadian in a British-style land and being American. The poem also reveals the heroic nature that more than one aspect of this war will take on as time goes on. Odell emphasizes that the Canadian and British triumph was grand and skillful, despite them being outnumbered. And he, naturally, describes the death and legacy of General Brock and his huge and wonderful sacrifice to serve the British cause. One that he encourages should be remembered for generations. The Battle of Queenston Heights, as seen through this poem, is a gateway to the mythologization of the War of 1812. It was an event of consequence that many could latch their imaginations onto, and especially coalesce around in times of war. Through 1813 and 1814, a series of battles and combats would erupt on the Upper Canadian border, where most attempts at entering Canada would be made, as well as near the coastline, where the British naval ships had arrived to form a blockade that restricted American troops to the land. Lower Canada was defended, but little risk ever breached that part of the colony, so for our purposes we won't touch on it too much. Many of these battles led to British victories, and the ones that did initially see American success did not remain in such a state for particularly long before the seized territory was retrieved for Canada. For example, in the summer of 1813, the Americans finally succeeded in taking York and installing a series of ships around the Great Lakes, where actually they would remain for quite some time. But before long, the British managed to regain control of the city of York through a surprise attack near Stony Creek. Later that same year, the one major invasion of Lower Canada took place, as 4,000 men marched towards Montreal. Unfortunately for them, they were halted by less than 1,000 of the British Canadian forces in the Battle of Chrysler's Farm. That lasted for a single day in November. It was also in 1813 that Tecumseh, who continued to fight alongside the British and to gather his warriors to their side, would die in the Battle of Moraviantown, as he and his compatriots retreated from Detroit after the Americans had regained control over the Great Lakes. This is important for a number of reasons. You see, Tecumseh was really the significant figure that was keeping the relationship between his Confederacy and the British going. Without him, not only did his Confederacy lose a strong leader and slowly collapse to the point that after the war it was virtually non-existent, but the association between them and the British became progressively fraught and unstable. Without a clear figurehead, both the British and his Confederacy lost some footing and an ally capable of gathering significant amounts of soldiers for the ongoing war. But as 1814 rolled around, it became increasingly clear who the victor would be regardless. The Americans were no longer as secure in their supply chain, and the British Army was far from being on the verge of collapse, especially that Napoleon back in Europe had been dealt with by that year, so more effort could be devoted to the American front. Yes, there were moments when Americans made notable advancements, but really, it was only a matter of time before the British won out. By that year, any American forces that had been near Lower Canada, most notably assembled on the Great Lakes, were expelled, and the British were either removing their own forces from the United States to let the Americans be, or they kept a presence in key towns and cities in order to prompt negotiations. It is during this point that some of you might have heard of the time that the British burned down or damaged American public buildings, including the White House. Fun fact, the name White House does come from the paint used to cover the discoloration suffered on the building. Oh, there you go. There's one retreat that hurt the British and their negotiation tactics in September of 1814, when General Prevost, who manned 11,000 soldiers, decided to withhold a capture of Plattsburg, which housed the comparatively few 4,000 soldiers. But all things considered, the British and Canadians had proved their point. It was over for the Americans. On Christmas Eve of 1814, the Treaty of Ghent was signed and peace, as well as the pre-war status of the border, was re-established. In fact, one of the things that was demanded by the British was the establishment on American soil of the native land that had been set aside for indigenous tribes in 1811 and that had caused so much strife for American expansionists in the first place. This was actually established for nearly a year until the Americans kept pushing west in 1815 and completely ignored it. Oddly enough, in 1815, there would be another battle between the Americans, led by later President Andrew Jackson, and their former colonial masters in New Orleans, not far from where Spanish territory began, right? Those allies of the British that I mentioned at the beginning. The Americans won, but at that point, it was over and nothing really came of it, except being a final thorn in everyone's side, I guess. So I suppose the war actually ended in 1815? Did they not get the memo out on the frontier? Now, I can hear you say, Patrick, this is supposed to be a podcast about history and literature, and we've only touched on one poem in like half an hour. I know, but the major part of the War of 1812 was less its immediate effects, but the aftermath. From it, as we'll see through John Richardson and Charles Sangster, an anti-American sentiment and a seed of nationalism grew out of a belief that Canadians, not the British, had won the war. And as time goes on, this war that really had little in terms of impressive moments or high stakes became the lightning rod for a Canadian identity. In 1828, nearly 15 years after the end of the War of 1812, John Richardson, a veteran of the conflict who had been captured by the Americans during the Battle of the Moravian Town, wrote a poem inspired by the hero who he saw struck down in the field. It is called Tecumseh, or The Warrior of the West in four cantos. Despite it being, as Professor Dennis Duffy from the University of Toronto says, a poem, quote, written in a mock epic verse form that undermines its claims to seriousness, end quote. Tecumseh is indicative of a time and moment in Canada's history that needs to be mentioned. Richardson was actually the grandson of an American merchant and a native woman, who unfortunately remains unnamed. And this might explain this particular affinity for examining the specific angle that Tecumseh provides when writing about the War of 1812. But interestingly, as many critics of the poem have pointed out since its publication, the poem is less about Tecumseh and more about the loss of the peace and tranquility that was perceived as happening in North America. It is about the chaos that comes with not only the arrival of the Europeans for the natives, but by extension of the context it was written in, of the Americans in Canada. You will find many stanzas that sound like this, quote, all is changed and desolate and wild. Each quay, where late the gallant ships were moored, laments a brother from its arms beguiled. The lake appears a bride who mourns her lord, the port, a mother who has lost her child, end quote. Now, there are other later poems that are specifically about Tecumseh and the help the natives provided to the British during the War of 1812, notably one from 1886 by Charles Mair, simply titled Tecumseh, a Drama. Despite it being even more nationalistic and relevant to the subject, I want to focus on John Richardson as an author who is bridging the gap, albeit in a weird and clumsy way, between the time the events took place and the time when more competent and nationalistic writings had fully developed about the war. Richardson's Tecumseh is a poem about change and chaos, something that was clearly striking a chord with many Canadians at the time. The War of 1812 provided a confusing but fresh opportunity to start anew and reassert oneself within the British Empire. But for me, the issue with Richardson's poem that possibly made it less of a success within its own time is not that the subject matter of change and continuation is impertinent. It's that it is written in an already past style of poetry. Rather indicative of the lateness which Canada would be plagued with for decades, Richardson is employing an epic style of poetry that is reminiscent of John Milton's Paradise Lost or Oliver Goldsmith's Deserted Village. It's as if Canadian letters were playing catch-up with the British sensibilities that had already gone by the wayside. And as such, this idea of change and getting away from the British colonial master that this kind of soft reboot that the War of 1812 was providing almost becomes desolate. For a nation that was trying to set itself up as special and unique, Richardson's Tecumseh is indicative of the conservatism and long journey ahead for Canada in reaching that goal. So he's taking this idea of a figure that would have been very much present in the popular mindset, but approaches it in a way that would have been ridiculous for English writing sensibilities. There's a discontinuity here that simply doesn't translate. So any power that Tecumseh might have had as an idea and an indication that we're trying to remember and evoke these senses of war that impact Canada and that indicate the need for Canada to develop these national myths for itself is kind of pushed aside. I want to end this episode with a poet that will get his whole episode soon, Charles Sangster. Sangster wrote a poem that I read a part of at the top of the episode, which was also called On Queenston Heights. Written in 1856, over 40 years after the battle took place, and after Jonathan O'Dell covered the subject. A comparison here is interesting, as Charles Sangster would also be known for writing Brock in 1859, which was commissioned to coincide with the unveiling of a statue erected in honor of General Isaac Brock at Queenston Heights. So around the 40 or 50 year anniversary of the War of 1812, where are we at with writings about it? Well, at this point, we have reached peak nationalism and hero worship for the people who had fought in the conflict. Remember, at this point in time, we are not so far from Confederation becoming a reality. It's about 10 years away, and the negotiations between the British colonies and among themselves are set to begin at Charlottetown in less time than that. Sangster's two works, especially Brock, are celebrations of the collective sacrifices of Canada to become something greater than itself. With an increasing will to attach themselves to moments, to these so-called turning points of history, and exaggerating them for idealistic purposes, Canadians are wishing, with the War of 1812, to inherit a heroic tradition outside of the British canon. So we've officially moved away from those sensibilities that were bygone and very conservative with Richardson's Tecumseh, although not quite, we'll touch upon that later, but there's still this will to move forward, and the bridge in the catch-up is getting, you know, smaller. The 1856 poem I quoted at the start of the episode is in so much more awe at the military prowess and courage of perceived heroes like Brock and Tecumseh than the Odell counterpart written in 1812. Here's another passage from Sangster's version of Queenston Heights to give you an idea. My brothers all, vanquished and victors both. And yet my heart leaps up, poor human heart, as I lean proudly with a human pride against this pillar to a great man's name. Yet I would rather earn that maiden's prayer than all the fame of the immortal dead.
There may be furrows still upon the field, plowed up by the wild hurricane of war on that eventful day. Here, certainly, an angry missile grooved this honored rock. Though nearly half a century has passed, the fissure still is here, and here the rust left by the iron messenger of death, as it sped forward like an angry fate, sending perchance 10 human souls to hell. There was pain. Here, where the wondrous skill of the mechanic with this iron web has spanned the chasm, the pulse beats hopefully, and thoughts of peace sit dove-like in the mind. Heaven bridge those people's hearts and make them one.
Not only is there a pride attributed to the heroes, associated as being fellow Canadians specifically, but there is certainly a will to show that Canada proved itself to the British motherland, that it made its maiden, as Sangster refers to Britain, proud. In Brock, through the use of the titular hero, Sangster wishes for Canadians to remember and value the exploits of the fallen, writing, quote, "The hero deed cannot expire. The dead still play their part." With Brock as his focal point, the poet emphasizes the past moments that are not to be forgotten, as they are the reason that Canada exists in its form today, a form that more and more people are happy with, at least on paper. I want to finalize with a question of sorts. Why the War of 1812? As you surely noticed, and as I mentioned more than once in this episode, the war is not as grandiose as we might expect for something that keeps coming up in the Canadian literary scene and that is pointed to as a significant moment in history. As we saw, the Americans, while putting up a valiant fight and going for the gusto, really overestimated their capabilities against the British and the will of the Canadian population to stay within a British society rather than become a republic. There were even battles in the past during which the Americans made much more headway into Canada than 1812. During the American Revolution, the Continental Army led by Richard Montgomery and Benedict Arnold made it all the way to Quebec City and stayed in Canada from November 1775 to the spring of the following year, after which the British and Canadian population had to force them back all the way to Boston over the course of many, many months. It seems to me that that would be a much more interesting narrative to focus on when creating a nationalistic moment of fighting against the Americans or of proclaiming this need to defend a territory. Well, the significant thing to remember when examining these types of moments is that context is really key. At the time of the American Revolution, when we refer to Canadians, it was still in reference to French Canadians mostly. Les Canadiens. There wasn't yet this concrete idea, or at least it had barely been adopted, of a Canadian people that included both French and English speakers that adopted a way of life suited for Canada. It was mostly the British in Canada and the French speakers who they administered. Furthermore, in the 1770s, as we have seen in past episodes, very few people wrote things down, and those who did so in a style that was very much nature-driven, or that addressed colonial or native issues, not yet nationalistic ones, if they existed at all, because, as you say, there's no population that kind of coalesces around the same idea, both French and English. It's still a work in progress by the 1770s. By 1812, though, things had already shifted. The arrival of loyalists, the development of Upper Canada, and the integration of British settlers into the Canadian setting in general made a much more distinctive culture possible. Now, there is the British administration and the Canadians they look over, French and English alike. These people, who have an increasingly important sense of self, are also now able to write more profusely, as the initial hardships of settlement and conquest are starting to fade in the eastern parts of the country, giving more time for people to concentrate on artistic endeavors. As the War of 1812 happens, it is inevitably much more present and certainly perceived as being important to the minds of people living through it. This is something that is lost when looking at the past purely from our present perspective, and that is gained from looking at how people wrote about their personal experiences, as we tend to do on this show. It's all well and fine to say that the conflict we talked about today was irrelevant in the grand scheme of things, or hardly of genuine importance in terms of military history, as little changed afterwards. But that isn't exactly true, is it? To the people living through it, it was important, and to the Canadians who remembered and wrote about it later, it became a point around which to coalesce with this distinctive sense of Canadianness. What makes the War of 1812 worthy of being revisited is how much power, thanks in part to the context surrounding it, that it had on the imagination of Canadians, and what they could achieve, exaggerated or not, and that these Canadians were a more average population. It was no longer just the lords and lawyers that were writing this poetry. It was everyday people who were actually living through these experiences in their daily lives. And that can't be discounted. Okay, that should be just about it for this week. Thank you everyone for listening. Now, on with the news I mentioned at the top. I set up a Facebook page and a website that I encourage you to check out. There you will find little historical tidbits and updates, as well as something very cool on the site, a recommended reading list that updates with each new episode. So if you want to read more about topics that we covered, check it out. The site is a work in progress, but at least that is set up. As always, you can support the show through the Ko-fi page, although in these times it is very understandable that such a request is unreasonable. I'm also in the process of setting up a Patreon page, so I would actually appreciate some comments as to what you would like to see on it that would incite you to contribute on a monthly basis. I've been thinking about producing some mini-episodes of about 15 minutes each that cover just a book or a historical moment in Canada as independent from each other. Think of them as providing extra context for the main show. You can respond on Twitter at Canlit History, on the Historia Canadiana Facebook page, as well as by email at historiacanadiana@gmail.com. That being said, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach out to me through those pages. I'm really trying to get a fun community going where ideas and suggestions can be exchanged, so please consider looking into it. Finally, if you could leave a review on iTunes or elsewhere, it would be very appreciated. It really does help. For now, I'll just say that I wish you all excellent health, and that I hope you and your loved ones can stay safe in these intense times. I'll see you next time on Historia Canadiana. Cheers, everyone.